music of Edvard Grieg and the evocative panel of Dr. Stephen Taylor once again welcome you to Let's Get Real. This is Dr. Jack Wan joining our producer, Reggie Van Stockham, in greeting you from the Shelby County Community Theater, where our agenda once again is the birth of realism. We have heralded the visionary work of Henrik Ibsen, a Norwegian, Anton Chekhov, a Russian, and August Strindberg, a Swede. These three enormous talents laid the foundation for much of what we do in the theater today, and to understand them is to understand why we do it and hopefully make us better at it. Ibsen advocated speaking out and decisive action. Chekhov, on the other hand, saw steadfast dependence on faith and work as the way to a far-off time when reason, goodwill, and decency would surely prevail. The works of Ibsen demand that the audiences see and are almost like dramatic sermons. Chekhov, however, requires no mandates to make points, to exhibit grand entrances, effective exits, or scenes of high climax. This episode will focus on Ibsen and Chekhov, leaving Mr. Strindberg to try to come to terms with his proclaimed atheism and exceptionally high morality. A tough position to maintain those two together. Let's begin this program with Chekhov's early play, Ivanov, in many ways the most underappreciated of all his major works. Once again, we are struck by the power of what the playwright leaves unspoken in his work, that undercurrent, that part of the iceberg that is beneath the surface. In this scene, the world-weary Ivanov is visited by his young lover, Sasha. Now, she simply wants to show her concern for him, but he takes the occasion to deride her rashness in coming to his home and to once again complain about his own failures and shortcomings. The resourceful Sasha, however, turns the conversation into an opportunity to try to teach the older man something about love. Here are Sarah Beth Gomelski as Sasha and George Robert Bailey as the despondent Ivanov.
Is that you, Sasha?
Yes. Hello. Surprised? Why haven't you been to see us for so long?
For God's sake, Sasha! This is most indiscreet. Your visit may have a very bad effect on my wife.
She won't see me. I came around the back. I'm just going. I'm worried about how you are. Why haven't you been over for so long?
My wife's depressed as it is. She's almost dying. And you come here? It's a stupid, cruel thing to do, Sasha.
I couldn't help it. You haven't been over for 2 weeks or answered any letters. I was worried to death. I imagine you might be in a terrible way here. Ill or dying. I haven't had one proper night's sleep. I'm just going. At least tell me you're well.
Really? I've worn myself out, and people never stop bothering me. I'm at the end of my tether, and now you turn up. What a morbid, neurotic thing to do. I'm so much to blame, Sasha. So very much.
How you love these awful, tragic speeches. You're to blame, you say? Very much to blame. Then tell me what you've done.
I don't know, really.
That's no answer. If you've done wrong, you must know what you've done. Not forging banknotes, I suppose.
That's not funny.
Is it your fault you fell out of love with your wife? Perhaps, but one can't help one's feelings. And you didn't want your feelings to change. Is it your fault she saw me telling you I loved you? No, you didn't want her to.
And so on and so forth. In love, out of love, can't help one's feelings. That talk's so cheap and vulgar, it's no help.
You were tiring to talk to.
This whole love affairs of ours is cheap and vulgar. He loses heart, feels he has nothing to live for. Along comes she, strong and confident, holding out a helping hand, all romantic and convincing in a magazine story, but in real life.
Life's no different.
You're a fine judge of life. Oh, I can see. My whining fills you with awe, and you think you've found a second Hamlet. But to me, my whole neurosis, with all its trimmings, is just plain farcical. And that's that. You should laugh yourself silly at my antics. No, sound the alarm. Bell all this rescuing and crusading zeal. Oh, I'm so angry with myself today. I'm so tense. I feel something's bound to snap. I'll either smash something or...
That's right. It's just what you need. Break something, smash things, or start shouting. You were angry with me, and it was silly of me to come here. All right, let off steam then. Shout at me. Stamp your feet. Come on, work up a rage. Come on, then.
You're funny.
Very well. We appear to be smiling. Kindly condescend to smile again.
I've noticed that when you start rescuing me and giving me good advice, a look of sheer innocence comes over you, and your eyes grow huge, as if you were looking at a comet. A naive man's a fool, but women have an art of being naive and carrying it off with such charm, good sense, and warm-heartedness, so it isn't silly as it seems. But why must you all ignore a man so long as he's strong and well and happy? While the moment he starts sliding downhill and feeling sorry for himself, you throw yourself round his neck. Is it really worse to be a wife to a strong, brave man than nursemaid to a whining failure?
Yes.
Why? It's a good job Darwin doesn't know, or he'd give you what for. You're ruining the race. All new babies will be sniveling neurotics thanks to you.
There's a great deal men don't understand. Any girl prefers a failure to success because... we're all fascinated by the idea of love in action. Active love, don't you see? Men are busy with their work, and love's very much in the background for them. You talk to your wife, stroll around the garden with her, pass the time of day nicely, and have a little cry at her grave. And that's that. But love is our whole existence. I love you, and that means I long to cure your unhappiness and go with you to the ends of the earth. If you go up in the world, I'll go with you. And if you fall by the wayside, I'll fall too. For instance, I'd love to spend all night copying your papers or watching to see that no one woke you up. Or I'd walk 100 miles with you. I remember once about 3 years ago, at threshing time, you came to see us covered with dust, sunburnt, tired out, and asked for a drink. By the time I brought you a glass, you were lying on the sofa, dead to the world. You slept about 12 hours in our house, and I stood guard at the door all the time to stop anyone going in, and I felt so marvelous. The more effort you put into love, the better it is. I mean, the more strongly it's felt. Do you see?
Active love. I see. Is that a perversion of some kind? Or just a young girl's idea of things? Or is it perhaps the way things ought to be? Who the hell knows? Honestly, I'm not such a bad man, Sasha. Judge for yourself. I've always liked generalizing, but I've never gone round saying things about our women being demoralized or on the wrong track. I've just been grateful, that's all. There's no more to it. Sasha, how amusing you are. And I, what a silly ass I am, spreading general despondency and feeling sorry for myself for days on end. But you'd better go. We're forgetting ourselves.
Yes, it is time I went. Goodbye. I am afraid our honest doctor might feel duty-bound to report my presence to your wife. Now listen. Go straight to Anna and stay with her. Just stay put. If you have to stay a year, stay a year. If it has to be 10 years, make it 10. Do your duty. Grieve for her. Beg her forgiveness. Weep. All as it should be. And above all, don't neglect your affairs.
I seem to have that horrible taste in my mouth. Again.
Well, may God preserve you. You can forget about me completely. Just drop me a line every couple of weeks. I'll think I'm lucky to get that. And I'll be writing to you. Goodbye.
Yes. Goodbye.
Thank you, Sarah Beth and George. Now here is a second Chekhovian disaffected character, the writer Trigorin in The Seagull. Trigorin is a very successful writer in the eyes of the world, but once again, as is often the case with Chekhov's characters, he is dissatisfied and spends much of his time unhappily lamenting his lack of power as an artist. Let's listen as Thomas Johnson takes on the role of Trigorin.
What success? I've never satisfied myself. I dislike my own work. I drift round in a trance and often can't make sense of what I write. That's what's so awful. Look, I love my country and its people. I'm more than an artist, aren't I? I'm a citizen, too. As a writer, I feel I must discuss ordinary people, their sufferings, their future, science, human rights, all that stuff. So I do discuss it, all in great haste, with everyone furiously hounding me in all directions, while I scurry about like a fox with a pack snapping at his heels. I seem to see life and yearning vanishing into the distance while I lag more and more behind, feeling like a peasant who missed the train and that everything I write is bogus through and through. I've never seen my readers, but for some reason I picture them as unfriendly and suspicious. I was afraid of the public. It terrified me. And whenever a new play of mine was produced, it seemed to me that all the dark-haired people in the audience were hostile, all the fair-haired ones cold and indifferent. My work goes on being nice and clever. Nice and clever till my dying day, that's all. And when I'm dead, my friends will pass by my grave and say, "Here lies Trigorin, a fine writer. But not as good as Turgenev. I feel I only know how to paint landscapes, and in all the rest I am false. False to the marrow of my bones."
Thank you, Tom. Let's move into the world of Ibsen now. One of the most confrontational of Ibsen's works is An Enemy of the People. In this play, a well-respected doctor and scientist discovers contamination in the spas of his native town. Now, these spas are the main source of income to the community. Pressure is brought to bear on the protagonist to withhold his discoveries to protect the livelihood of the town. Morally, he is unable to do this and becomes another of those figures who stand alone in Ibsen's works. In the scene which follows, the scientist, Dr. Stockman, is visited by his brother, the mayor. Ken Billings is Dr. Stockman, and Jeff Day, the self-serving brother.
"Peter, come in, please, sit. Maybe you find it a bit drafty here today."
"Thank you. Ooh, I think I caught a cold last night. I was freezing out there."
"Really? It seemed more on the warm side to me."
"I regret that it wasn't within my power to curb those excesses last evening."
"Do you have anything else in particular to say to me?"
"I have this document for you from the board of directors."
"It's my notice."
"Yes. Effective today." "This pains us deeply, but to be quite candid, we didn't dare not to, in view of public opinion."
"Didn't dare? Seems as though I've already heard those words today."
"I suggest that you face your position clearly. After this, you mustn't count on any practice whatsoever here in town.
To hell with practice. But how can you be so sure?
The Homeowners Council is circulating a resolution soliciting all responsible citizens to dispense with your services. And I venture to say that not one single householder will risk refusing to sign. Quite simply, they wouldn't dare.
I don't doubt it. But what of it?
If I could give you some advice, it would be that you leave this area for a while.
Yes, I've been half thinking of just that.
Good. Then after you've had some 6 months, more or less, to reconsider things, if on a mature reflection you find yourself capable of a few words of apology, acknowledging your mistakes...
Then maybe I could get my job back, you mean?
Perhaps. It's not at all unlikely.
Yes, but public opinion? You could hardly dare in that regard.
But opinions tend to go from one extreme to another. And to be quite honest, it's especially important to us to get a signed statement to that effect from you.
Yes. Wouldn't you lick your chin choppers for that? But damnation, don't you remember what I already said about that kind of foxy game?
But then you could imagine that you had the whole town in back of you. Now...
Feel now like the whole town's on my back. Mm. But even if the devil and his grandmother were riding me, never. Never. You hear me?
A family provider can't go around risking everything the way you do. You can't risk it, Thomas.
Can't risk? There's just one single thing in this world a free man can't risk. And do you know what that is?
No.
Of course not. But I'll tell you, a free man can't risk befouling himself like a savage. He doesn't dare sink to the point that he'd like to spit in his own face.
Very good. But there is another prior explanation for your stubborn arrogance.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, you understand perfectly well. But as your brother and as a man of some discernment, let me advise you not to build too smugly on prospects that may very well never materialize.
What in the world are you driving at?
Are you actually trying to make me believe you're ignorant of the terms of Morton Kill's will?
I know that the little he has is going to a home for destitute craftsmen, but how does that apply to me?
First of all, the amount under discussion is far from little. Morton Kill is a rather wealthy man.
I hadn't the slightest idea.
Really? And you hadn't any idea either that a considerable part of his fortune will pass to your children, with you and your wife enjoying the interest for life. He hasn't told you that?
Not one blessed word of it. But how do you know this for sure, Peter?
I have it from a totally reliable source.
My lord, then Catherine's provided for, and the children too. I must tell her.
Oh, don't say anything yet.
But what a beautiful thing to know they're provided for, that you are secure.
Yes, but that's precisely what you aren't. Morton Kill can revise his will any time he pleases.
But, my dear Peter, he won't do that. The man's enraptured by the way I've gone after you and your smart friends.
Aha! That puts a new light on things.
What things?
So this whole business has been a collusion. Those reckless, violent assaults you've aimed in the name of truth at our leading citizens were...
Yes, were what?
They were nothing more than a calculated payment for a piece of that vindictive old man's estate.
Peter, you're the cheapest trash I've known in all my day.
But you see, your dismissal is irrevocable. For now, we've got a weapon against you. I'm leaving. Think on that.
You scum. Oh.
Gentlemen, thank you. In that scene, Ibsen's The Majority is Always Wrong, and The Strongest Man is One Who Stands Alone reverberate strongly. At enormous cost to himself and his family, Stockman becomes an outcast and an enemy of the very people he has served so well. Moving back into Chekhov for a bit, let's take an intimate look at the young Sonya in Uncle Vanya. In perhaps one of the most moving speeches in all of Chekhov, Vanya's niece and fellow preserver of their family's estate, seeing how broken her beloved uncle has become, speaks tenderly to him of the life to come. This is that Chekhovian philosophy that we have emphasized so much. Endure, persevere, work, suffer. God will know. Here is Lethia Nall as Sonya.
Well, it can't be helped. Life must go on. And our life will go on, Uncle Vanya. We shall live through a long succession of days and endless evenings. We shall bear patiently the trials fate has in store for us. We shall work for others, now and in our old age, never knowing any peace. And when our time comes, we shall die without complaining. In the world beyond the grave, we shall say that we wept and suffered, that our lot was harsh and bitter, and God will have pity on us. And you and I, Uncle dear, shall behold a life which is bright and beautiful and splendid. We shall rejoice and look back on our present misfortunes with feelings of tenderness, with a smile. And we shall find peace. We shall, Uncle. I believe it with all my heart and soul. We shall find peace. We shall hear the angels. We shall see the sky sparkling with diamonds. We shall see all the evils of this life, all our own sufferings, vanish in the flood of mercy which will fill the whole world. And then our life will be calm and gentle, sweet as a caress. I believe that. I do believe it. Poor, poor Uncle Vanya. You're crying. There's been no joy in your life, but wait. Uncle Vanya, wait. We shall find peace. We shall find peace.
Thanks, Lethia. A truly beautiful moment. Something not emphasized enough as yet is the brilliance of Chekhov's ability to create individual characters so unique from one another. Each stands alone, with little resemblance to one another. There are truly no minor characters in a Chekhov play. They are all rich and offer great challenges to actors of all ages and types. The Cherry Orchard provides an excellent example. In this play, there is an eccentric governess named Charlotta. She has only a few scenes on stage, but she is truly unforgettable. Her declaration about who she is and where she comes from is a joy, and we are fortunate enough to have an actress who shares the love Chekhov had for his lesser characters. Here, as Charlotta, is Frida Vinegar.
I haven't any proper identity papers. I don't know how old I am, and I always think of myself as a young girl. When I was little, father and mother used to go on tour around all the fairs giving performances, and very good ones too. I used to do the dive of death and lots of other tricks. When father and mother died, a German lady adopted me and began educating me. Well, I grew up and became a governess. But where I come from and who I am, I've no idea. Who my parents were, I don't know either. Very likely they weren't even married. I don't know anything. I'm longing for someone to talk to, but there isn't anyone. I'm alone in the world. Well, what of that? I'm off. You, sir, are a clever man and a most alarming one. Women must be quite crazy about you. These clever men are all so stupid. I've no one to talk to. I'm lonely. Oh, so lonely. I'm on my own in the world, and who I am and what I'm for is a mystery.
Thanks, Frida. And by the way, this governess does magic tricks, too. We're going to stay with Chekhov for one more sequence and bring the beautiful Helen from Uncle Vanya back to our stage. Here she is scolding Uncle Vanya for once again declaring his love for her. Truth to tell, she is taking her own unhappiness in her marriage out on the already desolate Vanya. She, like so many of Chekhov's major characters, fears she has lived a wasted life. Jennifer Polisky is here to give us her take on Helen.
You have behaved abominably again, and today at lunch you argued with Alexander. How petty that is! There's no reason to detest Alexander. He's just like everyone else. He's no worse than you. You are both indolent and bored. Everyone looks at me with pity. Poor thing, she has an old husband. The sympathy for me, oh, how I understand it. As the doctor said just now, you all recklessly destroy the forests, and soon there will be nothing left on Earth. In the same way you recklessly destroy man, and soon, thanks to you, there will be no fidelity, no purity, no capacity for self-sacrifice left on Earth. Why is it you can never look at a woman with indifference unless she is yours? It's because the doctor was right. There's a demon of destruction in every one of you. You spare neither forests, birds, women, nor one another. It's quite possible, Ivan Petrovich, that the reason you and I are such friends is that we are both tiresome, boring people. Tiresome! Please don't look at me that way. I don't like it.
Thank you, Jennifer. We turn now once again to Ibsen's monumental Ghosts. Now, I say monumental because just as A Doll's House has often been called the first realistic drama, Ghosts in shape and dramatic structure is considered by many critics to be the perfection of realistic writing for the stage. It was far from successful in its time, however. The play was called everything from an open sore through a cesspool to a dirty act done publicly. The self-reliant Mrs. Alving was simply something the audience of that day was not ready for. Young Oswald, succumbing to an unspeakable disease, asks his mother for help with his final moments. Candace Cressy is the grief-stricken mother, Mrs. Alving, and Jeff Day returns to give us the tormented Oswald.
Has she gone?
Yes.
I think it's insane, all this.
Oswald, dear, has this disturbed you terribly?
All about father, you mean?
Yes, about your father. I'm afraid it's been too much of a shock for you.
But why do you think so? I mean, it came as quite a surprise, of course, but basically, it can hardly make any difference to me.
No difference? That your father was so enormously unhappy?
Naturally, I can feel sympathy for him, as for any human being.
Nothing more. For your own father.
Yes. Fathers. Father, I never knew him.
Well, that's a dreadful thought. Surely a child ought to feel some love for his father, no matter what.
When that child has nothing to thank him for, hasn't even known him, do you really hang on that old superstition? You're so enlightened and everything else.
And is that just a superstition?
Yes. You must realize that, Mother. It's one of those ideas that materialize in the world for a while and then...
Ghosts.
Yes. You could very well call them ghosts.
Oswald. You don't love me either.
I know you, at least.
Yes, I know, but is that all?
And I know how much you care for me. And I have to be grateful for that. And you can be especially useful to me now that I'm ill.
Yes, I can, Oswald, can't I? Oh, I could almost bless this illness that forced you home to me because it made me see you're not really mine. You still have to be one.
Yes, in a manner of speaking. You have to remember, I'm a sick man, Mother. I can't be concerned very much with others. I have enough just thinking about myself.
I'll be patient and forbearing.
And cheerful, Mother?
Yes, dearest, you're right. Now, have I taken away all your remorse and self-reproach?
Yes, you have. But who will take away the fear?
The fear?
Regina would have done it for the asking. And even though I can't work...
Oh, my dearest, you'll find yourself working again soon. Because now you won't have these worrisome, depressing thoughts to brood on any longer.
Yes, and now if I can only face this one more thing, Mother. We have to talk together.
Yes, let's.
And soon the sun will rise, and by then... You'll know, and I won't have this fear any longer.
Tell me, what will I know?
Mother, didn't you say earlier this evening that there wasn't anything in the world you wouldn't do for me if I asked you?
Why, yes, of course.
And you meant it, Mother?
That you can depend on. You're my one and only boy. I have nothing else to live for but you.
All right. Then listen. You have a strong, resilient mind. I know that. I want you to sit very quiet as I tell you this.
But what is it that is so terrible?
You mustn't scream. Do you hear? Promise me that. We're going to sit and speak of it quietly. Mother, promise me.
Yes. Yes, I promise. Just tell me.
Well, then you've got to realize that all this about tiredness... and my incapacity for thinking in terms of my work isn't the real illness.
What is the real illness?
The one I inherited. The illness that's seated here in my head.
Oswald, no!
Don't scream! I can't bear it! Yes, it sits in here and waits. And any day, at any time, it can strike.
It's not true, Oswald. It's impossible. It can't
be. I had one attack down there. It soon passed off, but when I found out how things stood with me, then this anxiety took hold and racking me like a cold fever. And with that, I started home here to you as fast as I could.
So that's the fear.
Yes. I can't tell you how excruciating it is. Oh, if it had only been some ordinary disease that would kill me, I'm not so afraid of dying. though I want to live as long as I can.
Yes, yes, Oswald, you must.
But the thought is excruciating. To revert back to a helpless child again, to have to be fed, to have to be... It's unspeakable.
My child has his mother to nurse him.
No, never. That's just what I won't have. I can't abide the thought of lying here like that for years, turning old and gray. In the meantime, you might die before me, because the doctor said it needn't be fatal at once. He called it a kind of softening of the brain, some phrase like that. I think that expression sounds so nice. It always makes me think of cherry red velvet draperies. Something soft to stroke. After I'd recovered from the attack down there, the doctor told me that when it struck again, and it would strike, there'd be no more hope.
That he could be so heartless.
I demanded it of him. I told him I had certain arrangements to make, and so I had. Mother, do you see this box?
What's that?
Morphine pills.
Oswald, my child!
I've saved up 12 of them.
Give me the box, Oswald!
Not yet, Mother.
I can't live through this!
You'll have to, Mother. You gotta give me this help.
I?
What more obvious choice than you?
I? Your mother?
Exactly the reason.
I, who gave you life?
I never asked you for life. And what is this life you gave me? I don't want it. You can take it back. Have you no mother love for me? To see me suffer this unbearable fear, please give me your hand on it.
If it becomes necessary. But it won't be necessary. No, no, that's simply impossible. Oh, what a fearful nightmare this has been for you, Oswald. Too much excitement. It hasn't been good for you.
Thank you, Mother.
But now you can have your rest. At home with your mother. My own dearest boy. Anything you want, you can have. Just like when you were a little child. There now. There now. The pain is over. You see how quickly it went? I knew it would.
Mother, give me the sun. In the sun.
What do you say?
The sun.
Oswald.
The sun.
What's wrong? The sun. Look at me, Oswald. Don't you know me? The sun. The sun. I can't bear this. Where did he put them?
The sun.
Here. No. No! No! Yes! No! No!
The sun. The sun.
Thanks to you both. A tough decision for a mother and for us, the audience. Once again, we are reminded that these writers were striving to pose questions, not to answer them. Directors universally let the curtain fall on a Mrs. Alving unsure what is the moral course of action to follow. In Chekhov's The Three Sisters, we meet a dashing military man named Vershinin. Now, he is in an unhappy marriage. It seems another hallmark of Chekhov is having people always in love with the wrong other people, impossible triangles. But after a tragic fire, this philosopher soldier laments both what has occurred and the future of a world that allows such things to happen. Ken Billings returns to our stage, this time as Vershinin.
How strange all this is, really. When the fire broke out, I ran home as fast as I could. When I got there, I saw that our house was safe and sound and in no danger. But my two little girls were standing in the doorway in their underwear. Their mother not there. People bustling about, dogs and horses rushing by, and the children's faces full of alarm, terror, entreaty, and I don't know what. It wrung my heart to see those faces. My God, I thought, what will these little girls have to go through in the course of a long life? I picked them up and ran, still thinking the same thing. What more will they have to live through in this world? When I got here, I found their mother here, shouting, furious. When my little girls were standing in that doorway, alone, in their underwear, the street red with the blaze and the noise terrible, I thought that something of the sort must have happened many years ago when the enemy made a sudden raid, plundering, burning. And yet, what a difference between things as they are and as they were. When a little more time has passed, say 200 or 300 years, then people will look at our present day life with horror and contempt. And all this will seem awkward, difficult, very uncertain and strange. Oh, what a life that is going to be. What a life. Here I am, covered with dirt from the fire and looking disgraceful. And I am philosophizing again. Please let me go on, my friends. I have a terrific longing to philosophize. I'm in the mood for it. What a life that will be. At present, there are only 3 of our sort in this town. But in generations to come, there will be more and more. A time will come when everything will change. Happiness is something we never have, but only long for.
Thanks, Ken. Although all 3 playwrights hold strong places in the early stage of realism, in our final scene, the famous writer Trigorin is found conversing with the fading beauty Arkadina. Here she has realized that her lover has become enamored with an aspiring young actress. Trigorin is considering an affair with the girl, and Arkadina will go to great lengths to hold on to him. She knows what buttons to push, and she does it. Here are Shelley Marquardt Reed and Jeff Schilling as the somewhat desperate actress and a writer who is about to destroy a symbolic seagull in the person of a young woman who adores him.
Page 121, lines 11 and 12. Ah, if you should ever need my life, then come and take it.
The carriage will be here soon.
If you should ever need my life, then come and take it.
I hope all your things are packed.
Yes, yes. This appeal from a pure, innocent girl. Why does it sound so sad? Why does it wring my heart so painfully? If you should ever need my life, then come and take it. Let's stay another day.
I know why you want to stay, dear. But you must pull yourself together. You're a little intoxicated, so sober down.
Then you sober down as well. Be reasonable and sensible, please. You must look on all this as a true friend. You're capable of sacrifice, so be a friend and set me free.
Are you so infatuated?
She attracts me. Perhaps this is just what I need.
The love of a little provincial miss. How little you know yourself.
You know how sometimes people sleepwalk. Talking to you now, I feel as if I was asleep, dreaming of her. I'm possessed by visions of delight. Do set me free.
No, no, no. You can't talk to me like that. I'm only an ordinary woman. Don't torture me. I'm terrified.
You can be extraordinary if you want. Young love, enchanting and magical love that sweeps you off your feet into a make-believe world. Can anything else on this earth give one happiness? I've never known such love before. Never had time for me as a young man because I was forever hanging round editors' offices and trying to make ends meet. But now, you see, this love has come at last. It calls me on. Why should I run away from it?
You must be mad.
Perhaps I am.
You're all conspiring to torment me today.
She doesn't understand. She won't understand.
Am I really so old and ugly that you don't mind talking to me about other women? Oh, you're mad. My marvelous, splendid man. You are the last page in my life. My delight, my pride, my joy. If you leave me for 1 hour, I shan't survive. I shall go mad, my wonderful, splendid one. My master.
Someone might come in. They might hear you.
Let them. I'm not ashamed of loving you. My dear reckless boy, you want to do something crazy, but I won't have it. I won't let you. You're mine. Mine. This forehead's mine. These eyes are mine. This lovely, silky hair's mine, too. You're mine, all of you. You're so brilliant, so clever. You're the best writer of our day, Russia's only hope. So sincere and natural with your spontaneity and healthy humor, you can put over the essence of a person or landscape with one stroke of the pen. Your characters are so alive, one can't read you without being moved. Too much hero worship, you think? Think I'm flattering you? Then look in my eyes. Come on. Do I look like a liar? There. You see? I'm the only one who appreciates you. I'm the only one who tells you the truth, my wonderful darling. Oh, you will come, won't you? You won't desert me, will you?
I have no will of my own. Never have had. I'm a flabby, spineless creature that always does what it's told. Surely that's not what women like. Take me then. Carry me off. But don't ever let me move one step from your side.
Now he's mine. Actually, you can stay on if you want. I'll leave on my own and you can come later. In a week's time. What's the hurry after all?
No, we may as well go together.
As you like. We'll go together if you say so. Come.
Thank you, Shelley and Jeff. Well, that does it. We have celebrated the move from a kind of mindless diversion in the theater through its transformation into a stage for serious consideration of important ideas. That's what realism did for us. That's why it's so important. The intelligent, moral, and popular theater dreamed of by our chosen artists came to pass. Now, where did we go from there? The pendulum always swings away from where it was, so next came all those isms that negated realism. Absurdism and all its relatives reacted to a world in which the total annihilation of mankind had become a real possibility. Now, what could that be but absurd? But that's for another set of programs. Maybe the new normal that challenges us now will allow us to once again take a careful look at the work we do and give that pendulum a little push to help us find our way to an even more powerful theater. The thinking actor and audience in support of brave writers can only add momentum to that push. On behalf of myself, producer Reggie Van Stockham, musician extraordinaire Stephen Taylor, an amazing dedicated company of actors, the Shelby County Community Theater, and somewhere up there, a trio of playwrights hopefully cheering us on. Let's continue to get real and make our job to do good work well. This is Dr. Jack Wan saying thank you and goodbye for now.